This is file 105. Today's date is September 2nd, 2015. This is Jean McMillan, and I am interviewing Mr. Roderick Blanker, who has been on innumerable boards for the 23 years that he's been in town. He's going to talk about some of the boards that he's been on, and we'll start with the genealogical information as background. What is your name?
My name is Roderick C. Lankler.
And your birth date?
February 14th, 1938.
And your birthplace?
Brooklyn, New York.
Your parents' names, please.
My dad was Ralph C. Conover Lankler, and my mother was Helen McDonald Lankler.
How do you spell the Conover, please?
C-O-N-O-V-E-R.
Do you have siblings?
I had one brother, Alexander, who was 10 years older than me and has since deceased.
What is your educational background after high school?
I graduated from St. Lawrence University, and I then went to Columbia Law School and graduated from Columbia Law School.
What year?
1963.
Perfect. You had a marvelous story about how you came to this area. Would you tell me that story, please?
Sure. I was on a thing called the Mollen Commission, which was a commission that Mayor Giuliani in New York City put together, and Judge Mollen was the chairman. And I was at a commission meeting early, and I had a map with me, and that map had on it a pin where we lived, which was at that time Ardsley, New York, and I had made circles, which I thought represented an hour from Ardsley or 2 hours from Ardsley, and we were looking for a lake to go look at because our four sons had decided that they would like to have a summer home on a lake. And as I'm looking at this, one of the commission members, who was Judge Tyler, Ace Tyler, he had been a judge in the Southern District Federal Court, came into the meeting and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm looking for a lake." And he said, "Well, don't look any further." And he pointed to Lakeville Lake and he got out a pen and he wrote down the name Borden with a telephone number, which he had in his memory, and he said, "That's where you want to go, and that's who you want to call." I think it was like the next weekend was a Labor Day weekend, and we, in 1993, and we came up and rode around. We found a house for sale on the lake, the only house that we saw. It had Gaby Real Estate sign in front of it. So we drove into town and looked for Mr. Gaby's office. And, of course, there wasn't any Mr. Gaby's office. It was Mr. Gaby worked out of his home, Larry Gaby. And so we just drove home. And after that, we then, I think maybe Barbara called Borden's office. And we set up an appointment to come up probably the next weekend. And Marty met us, and she showed us a couple of other places that were available, but then she had arranged to meet Larry Gaby, and Larry Gaby had arranged to have the owners of the house, who were Mike and Ellie Haupt, meet us at the house, and we all started chatting and had an instant love of Mike and Ellie, and we told them we were interested in the house, and they gave us a number, and we got in the car and drove around and wanted to come back with a counter offer because you never want to pay whatever anyone asks for.
Oh, yes.
But at the same time, we didn't want to be
You didn't want to lowball it.
We didn't want to insult them, and so we tried to pick a number that we thought was reasonable. We came back and we said, how about X or Y or whatever it was, and they said, that'd be great. And we ended up buying the house within a week of learning about Lakeville Lake, and fortunately, the Houps had a house on the other side of Twin Lakes, but they wintered down at Casey Key in Florida, so the house that we were buying was all furnished, and they said, we can either leave the furnishing theirs, and you can use the house until the spring when we come back and empty the house out, or we can empty it out now. And this, of course, gave us a chance to have that entire winter. I must confess, I didn't even realize when we bought the house that it was winterized. It wasn't something that had even occurred to me. That's how out to lunch I was.
No, but it's just a different environment and a different situation.
So we were able to come up, and we started coming up every single weekend, and fell in love with the place and got acclimated to it and started to collect a bed here and a couch there so that when the Houps took their furniture, we were able to move right in. And then we added on to the house, and our four sons have been able to come up with their families. And
it's a wonderful, wonderful spot.
Been great.
And you've been here now about 23 years.
Yep. Can't believe it, but that's right.
And you gave me a list of probably 12 different boards that you've been on. And I'm not going to go through all of them. And I don't know which ones were the early ones or the late ones, so I'm just going to throw out about 7 of them. And I would like you to tell me a little bit about numbers of members, term of office, the focus of the various buildings.
Okay.
But I want to start with the Visiting Nurses Association because they're such a wonderful organization.
Right. Wonderful organization and a really significant part of my life up here and our lives up here. We sold our house in Ardsley and moved up here in the year 2000. And in 2001, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. And I had a very successful operation, cancer-wise, but developed a horrendous infection and was very, very sick for a month, barely made it, and finally was able to come home. And Kathy Shortell was from the Visiting Nurses, and I really credit her with keeping me alive. Barbara, my wife, was on the board of the Visiting Nurses at the time, and I'm not sure exactly when, but at some point, Jim Bates came to me and said, would you be interested in going on the board of the Salisbury Visiting Nurses? And I said, Jim, I would do anything for the Salisbury Visiting Nurses. And he said, well, if that's the case, then how would you like to be president of the board of the Salisbury Visiting Nurses? And I said, "That I'll do anything for them, but that doesn't make any sense to me. There must be someone on the board who knows what they're doing. I have no idea what I would be doing." And he said, well, why don't you try it? So I agreed to do it. And the problem was that at that time, Marilyn Joseph, who had been the administrator of the nurses for 120 years...
Not quite that long, but a long time.
...had made up her mind that she was retiring and she was going to be leaving. And so before I took that spot, I extracted from Marilyn a promise that she would at least remain one more year, which she agreed to, and we went ahead and did it. And I knew absolutely nothing about how the nurses operated, how they survived, where the funding came from, what their problems were, other than the fact that Marilyn might be leaving, and so it was really a whole learning process. one which was made much easier by the quality of the board members. I have always told anyone who would ever listen that this was the finest board that I've ever been on. I couldn't get over the quality of the people on the board, and by that I don't mean to denigrate any other boards I've been on. It just was.
But this is a special board.
This was a special board with people who had a lot of experience in the financial world, and the nursing world, and the world of medicine, in running all of these kinds of things, and they were just great. And I think I did it for like 6 years until I twisted Ray Schwartz's arm to agree to become president, and I left. But during that time, of course, Marilyn Joseph left, and we had a really kind of troubling transition period, as you do when someone's been around for years and years.
It's very difficult to do a transition.
But we got through it, and the gal who got us through it, then after I left, she left the board, and we had our present administrator who's doing a terrific job.
You were on that board in the, like, 2007, you were president.
I think I probably went on it sometime around, gee, I don't know, I think probably maybe 2003 or 4, and I believe I was on it for 6 years. I think there were 2 or 3 year terms.
How many members were on the board?
I think about probably maybe 12 or so, and there were some who had been on the board, and their terms were expiring, and I learned that if they got an administrative position, you could hang on to them. So I created these sub jobs, like if there was a treasurer, I made Debbie Spaulding the assistant treasurer so that I could keep her on for another 3 year term. And
oh, you are clever.
These people were the kind of people who, instead of shooting me, they agreed to do it, and that way we kept some continuity of knowledge going with the thing. At the same time, we got on some really terrific new people, some of whom are still on the board.
Wonderful. I'm going to move on to Wetlands, the Conservation Commission.
Okay.
How did you get on that one?
That one was a result of a fit of pique on my part. At the time, Val Bernardoni was the first selectman, and Val was retiring. Mm-hmm. And I thought that in and of itself was a terrible thing to have happen, because I thought Val Bernardoni was one of the best administrators, and he wasn't a politician, but for somebody to hold a job like that, he was great. And my great fear was that he was obviously designating this young guy who was a tree hugger by the name of Curtis Rand as his heir apparent. And I was scared to death of Curtis Rand, because we lived on the lake, and I knew that the lake had all kinds of problems, and that Curtis was not going to be the type of guy who would think fondly of herbicides or mm-hmm. chemicals uh-huh. or anything like that. And so when he came to a Twin Lakes Association board meeting, meaning Curtis, I kind of went after Curtis, and I said, how come you don't have anybody on the Wetlands Commission, the Conservation Commission, who lives on the lake? And he said, oh, we have Norm Sills. He lives on the lake. I said, Norm doesn't live on the lake, and he's not a lake person. He lives, his property may board the lake, but he doesn't spend any time on the lake. And you have nobody on the, who lives on the lake, and the lakes are an important part of this town, and I think that you should have somebody on there so that you have a, they have a voice. And he said, well, would you like to be on it? And I said, yes. And he said, well, next time there's an opening, we'll consider you. And then he said, unfortunately, there's a member of the commission who now is quite ill. And so I may be talking to you sooner than you think. And indeed, the Lloyd...
Jane Lloyd.
Jane Lloyd... shortly thereafter passed away, unfortunately, and it's a terrible way to get on anything, but Curtis called up and said, you're still interested? I said, yes, and he said, well, come on down. We, some of the members would like to talk to you about it. And I went down and essentially got interviewed. And
I know what that's like.
I sort of, at this point, was beginning to become impressed with Curtis because he had kept his word and really seemed like he might do this, and indeed he did. He put me on the Conservation Commission. So I then started going to these meetings and learned that there was a lot more to that whole issue for the entire area than might be my selfish concerns about what was happening to the
lake. Not selfish, but focused concerns.
Well, they were focused, but they were also... I wasn't looking at the bigger picture. I was looking at what was concerning me and what was right in front of my nose, and that was that the lakes had problems.
So, how many members were on the board?
I'm going to say six, something like that, many of whom are still on it. It's a wetlands conservation commission that probably has more experience on it than any other conservation commission in the state of Connecticut. And there are people on there who've been Larry Burford, Steve Belter, Sally Splain. These are people who were on it when I got on it and had been on it for a good long period of time before, and they really know what they're doing, and it's an important important part of the town, and it's made a lot of difference to the preservation of the area that we live in.
What do they actually do?
Well, if you own some property that has either a stream going through it, or a pond, or a lake, or it has wetlands soil on it, and you want to do something on that property, you're supposed to check with your contractor, and if you're either in the wetlands area or a regulated area, and that is a certain number of feet away from the water line, away from the wetlands, then you should apply for permission to build or to do anything in that area. And fortunately, or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, there are a lot of wetlands in the Salisbury town area, a lot more than people think, and there's a lot of land that you wouldn't think would be covered because it would be up on a hill, but it is covered because it's wetlands, and it severely restricts what can happen in that area and the area around it. Septic fields, for example, cannot encroach on the wetland area, and has a significant impact on what can be built and where it can be built and how big the place is that you build.
I dealt with that when I built my house. How long were you on the board?
I'm technically still on it.
Oh, good.
I'm happy to say I am. And when we got our home in Arizona and we started spending the winters down in Arizona, I resigned as a member of the board and became an alternate member, so that when I am here, I am still allowed to attend the meetings and put in my 2 cents.
Oh, good. Oh, good. What technically is the term of office?
I think it... The answer is I don't know.
That's fair enough.
I think that you get appointed by the selectmen, and I think you get reappointed when they are reelected. So that each time that Curtis got reelected...
You all got reelected.
We all got reappointed. And I should say, after my remarks about Curtis, that he and I have become very close friends, and as a result of that friendship, I've been... he's the one who's gotten me more and more involved in town.
I noticed, because he was the one that gave me your name for an oral history interview.
Yeah, well...
So you can chalk that one up to him, too.
Okay.
Okay, let's go on to the Salisbury Forum.
Salisbury Forum. You had asked me last time how long that's been around. I didn't know. Yesterday I got a thing in the mail that they were starting their 10th year. So that's the answer to that. And excuse me. Val was still the selectman, and Frank DeChambeau was the one who started it, the idea being that we have a lot of people in this area who have a lot of knowledge about things and or have a lot of friends who have a lot of knowledge about things, and maybe we could have a lecture series where the public could come and hear some of these people talk on some various topics. And I think that the most prominent examples were Kitty Benedict knew Dan Rather from her career, and so let's get Dan Rather to come up and speak to everybody. And at that time, I think Dan Rather had been going through all sorts of problems at CBS about coverage and kind of a hot topic, and he came up and spoke, and it was quite a night. But at any rate, so a number of people in the community got together with Frank, and I was asked to go on the board, I guess because of my experience in New York City and with the Whitewater investigation of the Clintons, again, another very active board, Walter DeMille and Dick Collins, I can't think of all the other people that were on it, but we were the ones who tried to put together a schedule for a season and line up mainly speakers who were good enough to come for nothing.
Yes.
Because we didn't have any money. And we started a voluntary fundraising campaign and sent out the usual letters that you get so many of up here. But we were not going to charge admission. We had grants from the Salisbury School, Hotchkiss School, initially from the town and the Salisbury Bank. And when Val left and Curtis took over, Curtis didn't think it was appropriate for the town to be contributing to that, so he withdrew the town's financial support. The town continued to give other support, but not financial support. And we survived the early years, and I've been off that board, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 years now, but It's still going.
It certainly is. Going strong. When you were on that board, about how many people?
I think that there maybe have been somewhere between 10 and 12 who were on it. That board, you know, all the boards are different, but the attendance is always an issue, and mm-hmm. you get boards with more participation from the board members on some of them than you do on others. That was one other thing about the SFINA, the Visiting Nurses Board. I don't know that anyone ever missed any of those board meetings. If they weren't around, then we arranged for them to be on the telephone conference calls so that they could participate. But it seemed to me there were times with the forum board that we you know, we had some who participated more than others.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be the way it is.
Yep.
That the people that are truly dedicated make a point of attending the meetings.
Yep.
Marketplace. That's one I didn't know about. What's that one?
The Marketplace is a... in a nutshell, it's a board that exists to run Laban's. The building is owned by the Marketplace. The Marketplace is a corporation. There are shareholders, and at one time, the people in the community way before me decided that we needed to do something to keep a store in Salisbury so that if you wanted a loaf of bread, you didn't have to go to Canaan or Milledon for a loaf of bread. And the result was that people bought shares and they put some money together and put up the building that the President Laban's is in, and there's shareholders meeting. There's an annual meeting. I believe Ward Belcher is president of it at the time. And I was on the board, asked to go on the board of that, and went on the board of that. And for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years before I had a situation where I thought I should leave the board.
When you were on the board, how many members?
I want to say something like maybe 6 or 7. I would think that's probably somewhere in that area.
Was there a term of office or just ongoing?
There was a term of office, and at that time, I think it was year to year, there would be an annual meeting, and there would be a nominating committee would report the nomination of the officers and board members, and we would all sit around and re-elect ourselves.
Oh, clever, clever. How about affordable housing?
Affordable housing.
That's a hot topic, too.
Yeah. Jim Dresser, who, as you know, is one of the selectmen, is the one who really works hard and gets done with affordable housing really gets done because of Jim. And at some point, I'm trying to think of, time flies so fast up here, but he came to me and he said that there has been a small study done by a group of people, David Olson, Tony Scoville, one or two others, about affordable housing. They've filed a report about the need for affordable housing. There is a statute in Connecticut that says that every town must have a percentage of housing that is affordable housing. And if that law is not obeyed, there are
consequences.
And we, the selectmen, are thinking of having that smaller group study expanded upon and put together a committee to try to do something about affordable housing, and would you chair it? And I said I would, and they put together a committee that the selectmen put together a committee. I know your question's going to be how many were on it, and I think maybe
oh, unpredictable.
10, 12, somewhere in that area, but a real good, honest cross-section of the community. And there were people on there who have lived in the town, have grown up in the town, who have regular, normal kinds of jobs that keep towns going. There were people who had some big fancy jobs and had been weekenders, but now were up here. There was a terrific group, and we met long and we met hard, and it's the NIMBY factor, not in my backyard, was always looming and lurking out there, people, you could sense that around the table was, yes, we need affordable housing.
But not in my yard.
But
yeah.
Where are you going to put it? And so what we tried to do was demonstrate the need for affordable housing and why it was important for the town. And that, frankly, is easy because we have a volunteer fire department here in this town. We have a volunteer ambulance squad in this town. And if you don't have some young people who are living here, that's not going to be possible. And if that isn't possible, then we're all going to be paying higher taxes for a paid fire department.
The town dies if it doesn't have a viable source of young people.
Yeah. And I don't know what it is now, but at some point when we were doing this, the average age of the people on the ambulance squad had reached 55.
Mm-hmm. It's still there.
And, to call somebody up in the middle of the night because you've fallen down a flight of stairs or somebody's having a heart attack, it's kind of tough for a 55-year-old to have to get out of bed and get in an ambulance and come and get you up off the floor and take you to the hospital. So we need to have younger families being able to live in the area. And they can't because they can't afford the property and the real estate. And Rick Cantelli, the president of the bank, was on the board. He's talked frequently about the difficulty in finding local people, Salisbury people, to work at the bank.
Oh, yes.
And they can't do it. And there are people who travel in from Millbrook or from different areas. I'm just picking that out of the air. I can't name names or tell you who they are, but who commute to Salisbury to work, God bless you, at the bank. And so that's a problem. And I just heard recently that the nurses have a new program, and it's working. It's in the black, but it didn't make the kind of supporting funds that they had hoped it would, because they have to pay so much overtime. And they have to pay the overtime because they don't have the number of nurses to do
here.
The work.
Yeah, they and have they to commute.
And they don't, we can't, we don't have the nurses here because there's no place for the nurses to live. So, but more significantly than that, the law says that you have to do it, and we're not in compliance. So the main thing that came out of that committee work was the establishment of an affordable housing, I guess it's commission or committee, that is a town, it's now a town committee. It's supported by the town. They meet regularly. They've had various projects and events that are keeping the affordable housing problem in the limelight, and they're trying to do something about it.
How long were you on that board?
Are
you still there?
We were, you know, it was gonna last until we got the job done, and as chairman, I had this meeting at least once a month. I think that it was probably, I think at least 2 years, maybe more. We filed a report with the town that's anyone can read, and Jim Dresser was the one who did the great bulk of the work on that report.
Good. He's a good man.
He is a good man.
I'm now going to move on to the Rural Fitting Committee, followed by the Transfer Station Building Committee.
Okay.
Tell me about the Rural Fitting Committee.
Well, it's Luke Fitting. L-U-K-E Fitting. And that's that comes from the fact that there were two families who owned two houses. And the area around their property had been identified as a possible site for a new transfer station. The present transfer station has been, it's property owned by Hotchkiss. The lease runs out in 2020. It's been extended in the past, and it's been made quite clear that it's not going to get extended again. So what do we do? Number one, do you still need a transfer station? Should there be a transfer station? What are the alternatives to a transfer station? And if so, where are you going to put it? Now, if there's a NIMBY problem for affordable housing, there's a capital NYMB problem with a dump. Nobody wants a dump in their backyard. So
that's why it was up on Bunker Hill years ago.
Yeah, right. And so there had been a group, I think, hired by the town to try to go around and locate possible areas, and one of them was this property owned by the Lukes and the Fittings, and the Lukes and the Fittings are related in some way, but two houses over on the Millerton border, to buy it, you had to spend money. I think the amount was somewhere around $2 million, and you had to do something about the people who live there. So Curtis called up and he said, would you chair a committee to study this problem and to advise me and the selectmen and to present to the town the issue of whether or not a big hunk of money should be spent to purchase this property.
And how many acres is it, by the way?
I have absolutely no recollection of the number of acres. It was a big big bunch. We had to study the environmental impact. We had to study things like the wetlands that I've talked about, endangered species. Runoff, all sorts of things like that, and whether or not this would be a viable place to put it. And again, we had a group of people who, if the town had to pay for their counsel and advice, the town wouldn't have been able to afford it. But residents who had volunteered and brought their expertise to this committee. I do not include myself in that group. I think I'm pretty good at running a meeting.
I've heard.
But I don't know anything about the economics of it, like Zenas Block did, and many of the other factors that were involved in it. And again, it was a good cross-section of the community. We worked damn hard. I think we met as frequently as maybe two times a month sometimes. I think for a period we were even meeting once a week. Terrific attendance. We tried to divide the issues up that were facing us. And each had subcommittees who filed reports on each of those issues. We put together a paper for the town as to why we thought that the town that the selectmen should go to the town with the town meeting on the issue of spending $2 million for this property. As you can imagine, as we got closer to this, the resistance to the idea from those who lived in the area they believed to be impacted by the existence of the transfer station became stronger, more vocal, and indeed, at one point, there was not even unanimity on the committee, which I thought was disastrous. And by the time we presented it to the town, there was unanimity in the committee. There was a town meeting held at the Congregational Church. I've never seen anything like it in my
life. Everybody turned out.
Everybody was there. There was a line out to the street of people presenting their credentials for why they should be able to attend the meeting, and that they were property owners, and that they had a right to vote, and they all did. But they all got checked in. The church was packed. It was overflowing out onto the street. People had an opportunity to voice their concerns, to ask questions. It's a very, very civil meeting. Impressively civil. And some people felt very, very strongly about this. And those who were opposed were emotionally opposed to it and made a very good case. But at some point someone called the question and we had a vote. And I can't remember the numbers, but it was pretty much 2-1 in favor of spending the money. Another committee that I had nothing to do with was formed to bring Sharon and Salisbury together, and they decided to go ahead and to appoint yet another committee to build, to make the plans for building the transfer station. And on that committee, I'm on that committee.
Are you chair?
No, I am not.
Oh, all right.
Bill Braislin from Sharon and Kelly.
Bill who?
Bill Braislin from Sharon.
Okay.
And Charlie Kelly from Salisbury, the co-chairs. And we have met over the design of the transfer station, which will be built on the Luke Fitting property.
I'm going to go back, excuse me. How long did it take from start to finish to buy the property? I mean, from the time you started the study?
4 years.
Yes, I was going to say
5 years. Two things happened that just of interest. One, Hotchkiss got a new headmaster who all of a sudden said, "Why are we kicking you out? Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to me to kick you out. The kids can learn from all of this, and it doesn't seem to me we ought to kick you out. It seems like we ought to extend it." Well, that was a shock.
Yeah.
Particularly when we were right on the verge of going ahead with this, and became another issue, of course, for the townsfolks, if Hotchkiss wanted to do this, why wouldn't we let them? But the trustees of Hotchkiss, I think, had some problems with that, and that headmaster left. Mm-hmm. The second thing that happened was that the Lee family and the Lee farm out on the Millerton border went on the market, and the Lees were prepared to donate a large section of their property to the town to be used for the transfer station and for affordable housing. Now, how can you turn that down?
True.
Well, you can turn it down if you start to figure out what it's going to cost to bring all of the utilities and facilities way back into the Lee Farm property for the housing and all of that.
It was going to cost more money than it was worth.
And it was no longer affordable housing because you had to have sewage solutions, you had to have water solutions, utility solutions, roads, paving, everything. You know, every time one of those little events would come up,
that would set you back there.
We just went back to square one.
Yeah. With the transfer building, how many members?
I think that there's it's composed of a group from Sharon and from Salisbury. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say maybe 10. There are some alternates. My attendance has been terrible because we're in Arizona during the winter, but I've tried to stay in touch, and we have completed our work and have submitted a proposal and a budget which will be presented to the towns in the coming months. I know that there's, I believe, a September town meeting, education meeting, planned for Salisbury, and one, I think, in October, planned for Sharon. The thing about that group is that, again, you've got people who, you know, were from two different towns, and everybody got along terrifically. Everybody worked together. Everybody tried to keep in mind the sticker shock that's involved with something like this. It grew like Topsy, and people wanted to add this and add that. And at the same time, we're trying to say, no, you can't do that. Try to keep it simple so that it's flexible and can change as the trash business changes, and it also can be affordable for the two towns.
Do you have a figure for building the transfer station?
I think that the number that's being presented is around $3 million.
Okay.
And it's financing, and there was a preliminary meeting, and the public that was there who hadn't been through all of the stages of this said, why aren't you having this and why aren't you having that? And they were adding things to it, and the answer was because it costs more money and we're trying to keep the money down. I mean, do you pave the whole area? Do you put a cover over the whole area? All those things cost money.
Oh, sure. The last committee that I'm actually going to grill you on is SOAR, S-O-A-R.
Right.
Who started it, and what is it?
Well, who started it? The answer to that is Zenas Block. And its purpose, it's an after-school enrichment program for the students at the Salisbury Central School. And he thought that there should be an organization that could gather people together who could do things with the kids to essentially enrich their growth and their experiences. It doesn't perform the same function as Extra does, another great organization, It's not a child care.
No, it's not a competition. It's an addition.
It's an addition, and it's essentially to get a group of people who would devote their time and their knowledge and their talents to working with the kids after school. And there have been drama programs. There's been a fencing.
I love that one.
Program. There are arts and crafts, astronomy, you name it. There have been all sorts of things that have been done to enrich the kids' lives.
Which is great.
And the people who do that, who put that together, are the board members. Zenas put together, I guess, the original board and got people involved. Before he died, he asked me if I would do it. He had worked on the Luke Fitting Committee with me, mm-hmm. and had been the one who had really given us all of our economic advice, and he was a professor at NYU Business School. Brilliant, brilliant man. I cherish every minute that I had the opportunity to be with him. And so he asked me to be on that board. I told him I would. He said, would I do what I could do to get Dresser on it? I got Dresser on it.
And on the SOAR board?
On the SOAR board. And there was a gal, Amy Rasner Clulo, who was became the president of the board, who is a dynamo. And she's got three daughters she's raising, but she was a businesswoman herself in the human resources area, and devoted a tremendous amount of talent to the running of the board. And one of the, I think, major achievements that we accomplished was that we have formed our own 501c3, and so that we can get donations from the public, and it can be tax deductible, and we can be an independent organization financially. We had, before that, been kind of under the thumb of the Berkshire Taconic Group. That's how Zenas originally set it up, and I think it's been good for Berkshire Taconic and good for SOAR to have a amicable
separation
and to go on about its work. But the next time there is a drama or a musical put on by the kids, I highly recommend that you go to it because it's wonderful.
I'm sure. When did SOAR start?
I don't know.
Okay. All right.
I don't know when Zenas first started it. Janet Block would probably be able to tell you that. Or there's now a new president of it. Amy has stepped down, and but knows the answers to all those.
Wonderful. Before we close, do you have anything that you want to add to this? It's been wonderful.
Well, I just... I have found that living in this town and being able to participate in these different things has been a blessing.
And you have been such an asset to the community, and we're all so very grateful.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.